Hi, Matt.
Hello, Dave.
How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Not bad at all. Not bad at
good,
all.
Bearing up.
Strange days, aren't they?
Very strange.
Strange
yeah,
days.
Yeah,
we're strange. Having this... Well, thank you very much for finding the time for us. We're having this conversation just before the Easter weekend and soon after we've heard the news of Barry Hearn. And obviously he's somebody that you work for and know well. Just wondered how he is.
Yeah, he's okay. He's at home recuperating. He had, you know, magnificent treatment from the NHS staff at Basildon and Chelmsford hospitals. So, you know, big thanks to them. And you know, he's being looked after. He's in the best hands. So he's at home, fortunately, because you know, I don't think he wanted to be in hospital for any longer than was absolutely necessary, of course. And you know, he's got the Easter weekend to recover, and I'm sure he'll be back in the saddle as soon as he feels up to it.
And that really is very good news. What about yourself, though, Matt? I mean, obviously involved both in the darts and with football in these uncertain times. Everything's suspended. What do you think is going to happen next? What should happen next?
It's very difficult, isn't it? It's the great unknown, of course. You know, everybody's trying to plan, you know, at Orient and the darts and every other sport and every other, you know, company, really, in the country and mostly around the world are planning for something they don't know when they're going to be able to do. You know, we have to look at what's possible and what might be possible in different scenarios. If we can start again in a few weeks or a few months, what might have to fall by the wayside, and you know, maybe there'll be certain things that will come out of this and we'll do differently going forward, because this is a once in a generation, maybe once in a lifetime event that the likes of us, most of us thought we'd never see the likes of. So we're doing our best to plan. We're doing our best to keep you know, keep the wheels turning and keep paying people and keep everybody positive and optimistic, you know, and fingers crossed the tide will turn shortly.
And what about late Noenta? The players and the management assuming that the season will restart and trying to tick over with that in mind?
The direction we've had from the Football League is very much that the intention is to finish the season. Now, nobody knows what form that will take at the moment, but, you know, I have to say I agree with that. I don't think it would have been right just to void it or cancel it or whatever. So I think, you know, there is... Whilst there's still time, then that is the right intention. And if we can finish the season, and then even if we have to start next season a bit later or next season's truncated, I don't think that's the end of the world. Because for integrity, credibility, and I think that, you know, fans trust in the sport, it's important that what's gone over the last 6 months or so is deemed to be worth something.
Obviously, there's no football to watch, but plenty to talk about. You know, late-night supporters love talking about Jozo. I don't think I know anybody that knows late-night better than yourself, both as a supporter, a press officer, CEO, and now a director, of course. It is quite a CV. Can I start at the beginning, Matt, and ask why late-night?
So I went to Leighton Orient as a fan, if you like, for the first time during the 92-93 season. I've got a good friend called Chris Garrett, who's actually a doctor, working very hard at the moment. And we were walking home from school. We went to Wanstead High School together. He was a year or two older than me. And I said to him, "What are you doing at the weekend?" And he said, "I'm going to watch Leighton Orient play." And I thought, "That sounds good." I said, "Can I come with you?" He said, "Yeah." So we went along to Leighton Orient. It was in October 1992. And we played West Bromwich Albion. And we won 2-0. And I have a vague recollection of Sam Kitchen juggling the ball up the right wing. And that's pretty much all I can remember from that game. But I really enjoyed it. And I carried on going, you know, with him for the rest of that season. And then we started to do away games. And I just caught the bug, really.
And you got involved, didn't you? Were you with the fanzine at one point?
Yeah, I did start a fanzine. It was called All Aboard the Wagon Train. It's one of those things you look back and cringe a little bit, but it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun at the time. In the mid-90s, when the fanzine era was probably at its, you know, its peak, and it's great that we've still got two fanzines at the club, because not many clubs still have print fanzines, you know, but they are, I think they're a really important part of fan media. But we did one that was just messing around, really. We did 20 issues or whatever over the course of a couple of years, and it was all because at the time, really, I wanted to be a journalist, and I, you know, I started doing match reports for the Waltham Forest Guardian, and then the Ilford Recorder with the unmatchable Trevor Davis, and the Hackney Gazette at the time, as it was around then, and you know, things just went from there for me, really. I went to university. I managed to start working for Capital Gold Sport and BBC London as their Orient reporter. I think at the time, Dave, you know, maybe. you were on there, more different club duties, were you at the time? I can't.
Club call at that time.
Club call, of course. That's right. Yeah, the old club call. Yeah. So, I managed to go to most games I was lucky enough that the few quid expenses and stuff that I was getting managed to pay for me to be able to afford to go whilst I was a skint student. And, at the time when I graduated, the club needed a press officer, a full-time press officer, which it had never had before. But it was when the Football League centralised all its websites and they all took the same look and feel on, and things like internet highlights became a regular thing, and the audio commentary and stuff like that. So I just basically took on that role and went from there.
And you really were at the very start of sort of the explosion that happened and the change of media relating to the internet and everything that happened there.
Yeah, I mean, we actually had a website back from the mid to late 90s, really. Andrew Bonacori, the club's matchday announcer at the time, was very good on that sort of thing. And he set up a website, back in the day when I think even clubs like Man United probably didn't have one. So we were trailblazers, really. And then when the Football League took on those central rights, and the aim for that was to generate more revenue for the clubs, really. I know fans didn't enjoy the loss of identity of the websites, but the advertising revenue and the revenue from people subscribing to listen to radio commentary of the games and the video highlights and stuff like that was quite good for the club at the time. I think we had the best part of £50,000 a year out of it. And, it was a little grainy box in the corner of the screen with players looking like they were marching as robots across the pitch. But it was something that nobody had ever seen before, being able to watch match highlights so soon after the game on your own computer. And it was quite a thing.
And you and Andrew had quite a partnership, didn't you, doing the commentary?
Yeah, we loved it. We were really good friends. And, we used to travel all over and we had good banter. He brought in the text, the commentator, which, fans could do and send us in their stuff. And it was, very much in the way that yourself and Matt Hiscock do now. You have to bring it to life, don't you, Dave? Make it a bit of fun. And often watching Orient can be a little bit challenging, shall we say. So it's always good to inject a bit of something different into it.
And together, you were there at Oxford, weren't you?
Yeah, we were there at Oxford, although I wasn't commentating on the game then. I'd just been made chief exec a couple of months beforehand, so I was fortunate enough to be in the director's box. And it sort of came to pass that I managed to miss Lee Steele's goal that got us promoted, because word had come through that the goal had gone in at Northampton and Grimsby that had a massive impact on us. So I'd gone back inside into the corridor to find out if that was true or not. And when I came back outside, everyone was jumping around. So I just assumed that meant that they'd found out that the goal had gone in and we were going to go up by virtue of drawing 2-2. And then I found out 10 minutes after the match that we'd won 3-2. So of all the games I've been to and all the goals I've seen, I've managed to miss the one that got us promoted.
But you were there for the celebrations at the end. Prior to that, Matt, you were working incredibly hard as a press officer, and it was evident that you were doing far more than just the media work. But your promotion to chief executive came with you still at a very young age, didn't it?
Yeah, I was 26, and it obviously was a promotion above the level that I would have expected. But at the time, don't forget, the club had very small staff base. It was supported heavily by Matchroom, and there were only half a dozen of us who worked full time at the stadium on the admin side. Lindsay and I actually started full time at the club on the same day, the 2nd of July 2001. There weren't really many other staff. It wasn't as developed as it is now, obviously. So it was an unbelievable opportunity. And I remember when Barry asked me if I wanted to be chief exec, we were on our way to an FA Cup photo shoot at a local school. I think just before we played Fulham or Charlton it was in the fourth round, after we'd beaten Fulham in the third round. And, obviously I just accepted straight away. And then the sort of enormity of it dawned on me, not long afterwards. And it was an amazing opportunity. And to get the chance to do that at such a young age and with so little experience, I wasn't qualified in business or law or accountancy or anything like that. So I basically had to do my best to learn on the job and hope I've done okay and repaid that trust that Barry put in me.
Well, you certainly have, Matt. There's no doubt about that one. And there must have been some very difficult decisions along the line because, I mean, life in the higher standard started very well, didn't it, for Martin? But as all these things happen, you know, expectations are very high and difficult decisions have to be made.
Yeah, and it is hard. And I remember, and I still talk to Martin about this today, you know, when Martin left us as our manager, I don't remember, there wasn't a single fan in the ground who chanted Ling out or anything like that. You know, people just knew that it had come to the end of its natural lifespan. And you know, Martin acknowledged that. And I think he had a sense of relief to some extent as well. And, you know, there's been other decisions over the years that or potential decisions. I remember standing, I was actually standing because I had a bad back and they opened the upper tier for me away at Bradford. We had a game away at Bradford at the end of the season a couple of years later. And had we lost, I think it would have been almost certain we were relegated. And then you think to yourself, well, if we lose this game today, which two members of staff are going to have to be made redundant because we've gone back down to League Two and stuff like that? And they're real decisions, you know. There's a lot of decisions out there that are just cosmetic. But when you start playing with people's livelihoods, you know, whether it's sacking them, making them redundant, changing the roles that they do, or the positive side, promoting them, giving them opportunities, you know, bringing them in and helping nurture them, you know, they're real decisions.
Most inspired decision in many ways was the appointment of Russell Slater. I must admit, Matt, at that point, I didn't think there was any way that Leighton Orient would be saved. I can remember shaking his hand on the open terrace at St James's Park, just ahead of a goalless draw against Exeter City, and, you know, wishing him good luck. But I didn't think we'd be able to turn it round. It did seem to be an enormous ask at that point, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. But Russ was the right man, and it just sort of came to me. I remember we relieved Geraint Williams of his responsibilities after a home defeat against Hartlepool. We were 3-0 down at half time and we hadn't even really considered changing the manager, even though we were struggling because we weren't that sort of club. And although we ended up losing 3-2, I think Barry just sort of said, look, we're going to have to do something here to try and avert the slump. And we had Kevin Nugent, who was an ultra safe pair of hands and a really good club man, a great coach, great with the players, you know, we knew that he could steady the ship for a couple of games. But in the same vein, we thought we perhaps needed an injection of something different. And Barry said to me, it was over just before the Easter weekend, I think, he said to me, have a think about who you think it should be. And I went back, and my sort of usual thing for finding a manager was just really think of the criteria, you know, what have they done in their careers? Do we want someone who's saved clubs from relegation, someone who's got promoted, someone who's got a certain win rate, someone of a certain age, someone of a certain geography, all those sort of things. And then you literally go through the list of everybody who's anybody and narrow it down. And it pointed to Russ, and I phoned Barry. I remember saying to him, I think Russell Slade's the man. And he went, what, that bald northern bloke? And for the first thing, is Russ was born in Surrey. <You know? laughs> Well, I obviously won't question the amount of hair he's got on his head. I said, yeah, I said, I think he's the man. I think he can do it. And he said, well, I don't know, you know, but sort of didn't really have any great claim for any sort of any reason, you know, for or against him. He said, but if you think he's the right man, then let's give it a go. So I knew Russ's agent, Dean Baker, and that wasn't why he got the job, by the way, because I've known Dean for years and, you know, on lots of different levels. And I phoned him. I said, what about Russ? So he gave me his number. I phoned him up. He was at home in Scarborough. And I said, can you come and watch our game? It's tomorrow away at Southampton, which is hardly round the corner from Scarborough, let's be honest. And Russ said, yeah. He said, I'll be there. And he drove all the way down, I guess, with his friend from Scarborough to Southampton. He watched the game, and I think Nuge was in charge. I think we lost 1-0, but we put up a decent show. And Barry phoned me after the game, and he said, how was it? I said, well, we tried hard. You know, Southampton, much better team than us, but we tried hard, blah, blah, blah. He said, well, was your man there? I said, yeah. He said, well, just tell him, he's got six games. If he can keep us up, he said, I'll pay him, I think it was 10 grand. He said, and if he keeps us up, I'll double it. So I phoned him. I said, where are you, Russ? He said, oh, I'm in the car. I'm on the way back now. I said, well, I need to talk to you. So he turned around. He came back into the, I think we were in like the corridor at the main stand at St Mary's. I said, well, look, you got six games. This is the money. You start tomorrow. Do you want it? Yes or no? He said, well, can I think about it? I said, no, you've got to tell me now. And And he said, all right, then I'll do it. I was like, okay, great. He said, well, when's their day off? And because it was Easter Monday, that game. And I said, their day off is Wednesday. He said, well, tell them their day off tomorrow because I need to get back to Scarborough and get some stuff. Can you sort out somewhere for me to live? And I'm thinking, yeah, we've got a flat on the ground. We can do that. Just get back up to Scarborough, get your stuff, get back down. So I told Nuge, he was fine. The players were fine. And it was actually quite funny because before the game, Martin Allen had gone to the game as well, which is quite a common thing for an out-of-work manager to do. And Martin Allen came in and was talking to me in the director's box before the game, and I saw Stephen Purchase on the pitch look up and spot me talking to Martin Allen, and he nudged the other players around him and pointed up, and I could tell that they all thought, it's going to be Martin Allen. So I thought, I'll have some fun here. So I carried on talking to Martin Allen for about 10, 15 minutes. I was laughing and joking with him, putting my arm around him, pointing to different players and stuff like that. And I could see that our players on the pitch were thinking, oh, it's going to be Martin Allen. And don't get me wrong, Martin's a great guy and he's done really well at keeping clubs up from relegation and stuff like that. But I think he's maybe a bit of an acquired taste for some people. So it was quite funny. Anyway, Russ came back down and we had the game away at Exeter, as you mentioned before. And I phoned him on the Friday and I said, how do you think we'll do? And he said, I think we'll draw 0-0. He said, I'll get them tight. He said, but I don't think we've got a goal in us. And if you remember, that was exactly what happened.
It was. And they were very tight, which was a change.
Exactly. And we had Norwich and Stockport at home, I think, in successive home games. And he got Sean Thornton firing that free kick Sean Thornton scored. Yeah. And, you know, and he ran up the touchline and took his cap off. And then we just thought, yeah, do you know what? We'll do this. And I think we actually did it with a game to spare in the end.
Yes, it's true, yeah. Yeah. I think Russell's a remarkable man. He's never had a relegation. He's never had a promotion on his CV, has he?
Yeah.
He lives so close.
Oh, he's been so unlucky. I mean, I've seen him lose at Wembley, obviously, with us, but also with Yeovil. My dad's a Blackpool fan. He's from Blackpool, so we'd gone to see Blackpool that day. And, you know, he's obviously... He's unfortunately never had a promotion, but nobody deserves one more than him. And whether he gets another chance now or not, I don't know. But he definitely deserved one with us, didn't he?
Let's talk about that day at Wembley, because, you know, 2-0.
Oh, well, do we have to?
But the bit we really haven't considered, not just the game, but what was happening in the seats at that point? Because was the takeover being considered at that point?
The club was sold. The club was sold at that point. The club was sold. So, you know, it was all a question of the final details, which depended on whether we were a League One club or a Championship club. You know, it was just waiting for the contracts to be signed. It was all, you know, it was all done and dusted. And, you know, I think we'd managed to keep it from everybody because it was the right thing to do. You know, I remember telling the staff in the office a few weeks after, you know, and we took the players to Vegas and Barry sat down, had dinner with the staff then and told them all. And yeah, it was, you know, it was kind of all done. We sat there, you know, at Wembley that day knowing it was our last game.
And that must have been really strange and really difficult for everybody involved, I suppose.
Yeah.
From a distance, it made sense in terms of injecting cash into what was already a very, very good team. It seemed to be an opportunity to take the club to the next level. But I don't know about you, Matt. It seemed to be very wrong very early. I can remember a pre-season match at Dartford speaking to Russell Slade, and Russell was sort of complaining about the new director of football and his relationship. And I said to Johnny Davis afterwards that, you know, this is odd. I've got an interview with the manager talking about the director of football and he hasn't been announced yet. And everything seemed to be all over the place.
It was clueless. And it became obvious very early that it was the wrong move and they were the wrong people, which was a shame because there was no doubt the deep pockets were there, as everybody saw over the 3 years that followed until he pulled the plug on the money. He was spending left, right and centre. And actually, I don't want to use the word spending. I want to use the word
wasting.
He was wasting money left, right. There was no improvement in infrastructure and no progress. You know, it was hanging on by its fingertips, despite the fact that, you know, people who shouldn't have been at the football club were just absolutely rinsing it dry with some, you know, we had players earning, you know, best part of £10,000 a week. And, you know, it was just awful. So it was a shame because, as I say, it became obvious early. And, I did my best in the first couple of weeks. I was supposed to stay on for a year, as I think people we were around at the time may remember. I was supposed to stay on for a year to help with the transition. And I kind of did my best to in the early first couple of weeks to... you know, to integrate the new staff. And some of them were nice guys, you know, and there was a guy who was supposed to be the chief exec who had a row with Becchetti a couple of days before the press conference, and he disappeared. And it was a shame because I can't remember his name, but I think if he'd have stuck around, it could have been different, because Alessandro, who was there, was the production manager for the reality TV show on Becchetti's Italian TV channel. So, you know, just how he ended up as chief executive was more of a strange career jump than mine, you know, and he obviously didn't know anything about the club. So it became obvious quite early that it was just all about fulfilling the new owner's wishes, regardless of anything that happened around that. And some of the stuff they said to Russ was ridiculous. You know, they were looking at signing players who were on £30,000 or £40,000 a week who wouldn't have come to Leighton Orient in a million years. They just didn't have a clue. They thought they could just buy anything. There was no regard for the staff or the fans or anything. And what was frustrating was that, you know, I was obviously, I left, I think, at the end of September. They asked me to leave the board. And then I still had people on the inside who were sort of talking to me and, were going forward and backwards with bits of advice, and they were giving me bits of information and whatever. And it was so obvious that it was going to be a disaster, and yet it was so hard to do anything, or impossible to do anything about it, which made it all the more difficult.
And it was so difficult, Matt, to see good people treated so badly, and that included yourself. You must have felt so embarrassed, because at the time you had a position with the league, didn't you?
Yeah, that was really frustrating. I'd only just, 3 months early been elected onto the Football League Board, which I was very proud of, and to have to resign from that position. And one thing I will say, there was a couple of other club owners who said, if you want to come on our board so you can keep that position going, then we'll do that. And I thought that was really, really good of them. But it wouldn't have been the right thing to do, because I wouldn't have had any affiliation to their club. So, I had to resign from the Football League. And the Italians didn't understand that it was actually quite useful to have somebody at your club on the Football League board from a position of information and influence and things like that. So they just, that was a shame. And then, really good, solid members of staff. I was so pleased with the staff that we'd built up there. You know, a good combination of local people who understood the club and would give it 24/7, 365 days a year alongside, young and energetic staff. And if you look, it's not a coincidence that people who worked for the club then, who are not there now, have gone on to work in decent roles at decent football clubs. You know, Tom Jeffs went to Portsmouth, Rob Noble at Scunthorpe, Johnny went to Spurs and is now at the Premier League. You know, there were decent people there who went on to work well in football. And of course, all the other members of the coaching staff who left, Kevin Nugent, Kevin Dearden, Russ got a great job. You know, they all took other jobs. Joe Sharp, who was one of the physios, there'll be others as well. You know, these were good people, and that's testimony to the fact that they all had careers in football. It wasn't that they just disappeared out of the game. So the way they were treated was, was just so wrong and such a waste for the football club.
It's a bit of a cliche, isn't it, Matt? That people often say that football's all about the money. If you ever wanted an example to say that football's so much more than just about money, you just look at what happened to the O's. But towards the end, you continued to work very hard behind the scenes, didn't you? Looking at plan Bs and Cs and such.
Yeah. Once it became obvious that it was over for the Italians, as in it was an irretrievable position and they'd lost interest and lost the desire to fund it, then that was when we really had to move into shape. And I, Loft were doing really well with their protests at the time, and I did some bits with them. We had a meeting at the Birkbeck pub and, sorted out the banners and stuff like that. And their protests definitely, captured the headlines and really raised public consciousness. And at the same time, I'd been in constant contact with Nigel Travis, who I'd known since he was a sponsor, and his dad used to be in the boardroom before he passed away. And Nigel and I just kept in touch on email. And I just, I sent him an email one day saying, well, Nigel, you said you didn't want to own the club, but you'd save it if you ever had to, and now's the time to save it. And he phoned me straight away and he said, let's do it. So, fortunately, we got over the line. It just took a bit longer than we'd have wanted to.
The contrast in terms of the leadership and the style and the culture of now to then is remarkable. Kent Teague's a big player with that one. And I think you were the person that introduced Kent to the joys of Brisbane Road, weren't you?
Yeah, I was. I mean, Kent had been introduced to Nigel via a mutual contact in America, and they'd hit it off straight away, which was great. And Kent's first taste of Orient, as most people will know, I think, was watching the live stream of the Colchester match that was abandoned. So he could sense the passion and the, you know, the what was coming out from the fan base. And I think that really hit him straight away. And he came over and we had a meeting at Nigel's flat in Notting Hill. And there was a few others there. I think Marshall was there as well. He was involved right from the start. Another chap called Paul who was involved that sort of dropped out. And Nigel's son, Dave. And we had a meeting, and then kind of things sort of finished. And Kent didn't really have anything to do, so we went for dinner. And then we were the only people in the restaurant, so it only took about an hour to have the dinner. And then I thought, right, well, we've got to do something else now. So we're in Notting Hill, and I said, well, do you want to see the stadium? He said, oh, that'd be great, yeah. And I thought, well, he's like, you know, he's a really rich American guy, and he's not going to want to go on the tube, is he? So I'm thinking, well, if we could get on the tube at Notting Hill, we could be at Leighton in half an hour. And I thought, no, he's not going to want to do that. So we have to get a taxi. And we were in this taxi for about an hour and a half. The traffic was terrible, and I'm thinking he's going to be getting bored, and he's going to think, what am I doing here, blah, blah, blah. And I phoned Lindsay and said, look, I know it's 9 o'clock at night, and I know you're at home, but can you do me a favour and come and unlock the stadium so I can show this guy around? We got to the stadium, it was pitch black, and we walked around it, and I was trying to explain what things were to Ken, and he seemed to love it, which was great, because I was so worried that he'd had such a boring taxi journey over there, where I'm sort of going, that's Big Ben, and that's the Tower of London, and whatever. But yeah, fortunately, he was smitten.
Things moved so quickly after that, didn't they? And they needed to.
Yeah, they did to a point. I mean, we should have been done by the end of January, and that was our intention. If we'd have done that, then I think we'd have remained a Football League club, because it wouldn't have been that hard to have resurrected things for the last 3 months. But the Italians dragged it out with ridiculous comments, and then there was this so-called other consortium that were interested that we were never really too convinced about, to be perfectly honest. So we held our nerve, and it was dragged out. And you know, we were making plans, because you had to. You know, Martin Ling was involved, and, you know, we were talking to staff members and people we wanted to bring in. But it got to the point where we said, if we haven't got this done by the end of June, we will have to pull out, because they'll be back for pre-season training, and it'll be too late to influence next season and in the National League. You know, it wouldn't have been, you know, practical to have started halfway through. So fortunately, you know, we got there with 8 or 9 days to spare.
And thank you for doing that, Matt. And, you know, I suppose there weren't many positives from that era, but one was that Orient were together. So the fan base was united, and that was the sense you got for that first season in the National League, and it was an eye-opener, wasn't it? Especially Bromley away.
Well, yeah, I mean, some of those places, you know, I mean, I remember going to Guiseley, and do you know what? I had a conversation with Gary Sweet, who was managing director of Luton Town, and he gave me a really interesting phrase. He said, in the first, because if you remember, Luton were non-league for a few years. Yeah. He said, in the first year, it's a bit of a novelty. Every game's like an FA Cup first round game, and new grounds for the fans and new towns to go to, and some of it's quite rural and quite picturesque and all that, so people quite like it. In the second year, they expect you to win. In the third year, you have to win. And by years 4 to 6, they hate the sight of you. And I think he might have put a hate the something sight of you into it. And you can relate to that, because that first year was a bit of a novelty, and there was the feeling that we got the club back and that everyone was together, and, you know, things didn't work out with Steve Davis, but as soon as Justin had come in November, we were moving in the right direction, and, you know, there was the communication, the link between Nigel and Kent and the fan base was great, and Danny came in to lead things, you know, in the office and whatever, and it was good. And then in the second year, obviously, we had a great season and culminated in the promotion. But you just get a sense, when you look at it now, you think, imagine if this coronavirus issue was us last year now. Yep. And we were facing up to the prospect of a third, fourth year, whatever it would be, in the National League. You know, that novelty's worn off. Yeah. Cash flow's dried up. There's still no away fans coming. You know, we're still not able to keep hold of good players that we want to keep hold of, or sign good players we want to sign. All these issues, you know, would have been exacerbated. So, you know, fortunately, I think probably 2 years was the right time, was the right amount, perfect amount of time to get out of it. 1 year might have been a bit quick for us. We might not have been rebuilt enough to have coped with the league. But 2 years was, you know, was spot on.
Matt, all those years at Leighton, I mean, you'd had some highs and lows, but you've not dealt with anything like the tragedy of this summer and the loss of Justin Edinburgh.
Yeah, of course, you know, something that still affects us to this day, you know, and when you look at what's happening now and, you know, what happened back then, it was, you know, it's been a hell of a year for us to have to, or a hell of a season for us to have to deal with everything that's gone on off the pitch. So it's been really sent to test us and, you know, we miss Justin terribly still. But I get the sense now that you know, under Ross and with the group of players that we've got, there is a renewed focus, determination and, you know, we want to move forward to honour him and to reward what he did for us.
As we said, the fan base were united. It felt that in many ways the appointment of Carl Fletcher changed that, not least in terms of the trust in making the right decisions, because up until then the decision and the one to appoint Justin clearly was an inspired one.
Mm.
How difficult has it been to recover from that setback and that appointment?
I think I would say we're probably, you know, if you think back to our last game, I think we beat Cambridge at home, didn't we, before the break, you know, I would say that was a decent sort of benchmark to show that, you know, Ross had been able to turn things around. I know there's some fans out there who don't want Ross as the manager, but, you know, he's the person that we think is able to take us forward. And I think what's been happening over the last couple of months has shown that, you know, that the appointment of Carl Fletcher was a risk in so much as he was no link to the club and he was unknown and unheralded and whatever, but it was made for the right reasons in so much as he fit the bill of the type of person we wanted to bring in at the time, and he was very impressive in his interviews and he had a great CV, great references. It just, again, you know, maybe a little bit like with the Italians, it just didn't fit. And we took we could have stuck with it, you know, only to won a few games, lost a few games, would have drifted along, blah blah blah. But actually, we thought, no, look, let's, for the benefit of everybody, including Carl, let's make a clean break. And that was the decision we made. Obviously, you know, some fans have lost a bit of trust and a bit of faith in the club because of that, and that's a shame, but understandable. But I would hope that they would be objective enough to understand that, you know, if football is not a perfect science, and you can't get every decision right. And, you know, it's up to us now to rebuild and get to where we want to be.
And it's been a remarkable period for Ross Embleton. I mean, the situation he finds himself in now feels so different to the situation that it was in the summer when he stepped up, when he must be under enormous pressure, but also suffering himself personally, but he supported other people. In many ways, the Carl Fletcher period seemed to provide a bit of a watershed, and since then, it's easier for for Ross to follow Carl than it would ever been to follow Justin. Is that fair?
I think that is fair. I think you don't, whatever you're doing in life, you don't want to be the man who follows the man, do you? It's a little bit like when David Moyes had to go into Manchester United and emulate Alex Ferguson or whatever, you know. But for Ross to come in and be immediately off the back of Justin was an impossible task, and one that you wouldn't wish on anybody. And it wasn't a surprise that he felt at the time that it wasn't something he wanted to do longer term. But I think that opportunity he had to step back a bit when Carl was in there gave him a chance to look at it through a different pair of eyes and take a long-term view and be able to look forward instead of looking back, because, you know, that's ultimately what we've got to do. And I think that opportunity, you know, made him able to reassess himself and, you know, make the decision that what he knows about Leighton Orient, you know, is well, he knows a hell of a lot about Leighton Orient. It's good information. It's, you know, he's a good coach. He's a good person, and he's got the faith of the players. So, you know, we're a lot more confident than we were. You know, he is a lot more confident than he maybe was at the start of the season when he took over. And I think maybe that little spell between August and sort of November, December will do him good in the long term as a learning experience.
In conclusion, Matt, can we look back and sort of particular highlights, but also your hopes for the future, please?
Okay, I mean, my highlights have been, they look the same as everybody else's, you know, the 05-06 season, the 13-14 season, the National League winning season. They're the seasons that stick in the mind, but not just because they were successful on the pitch, but because we were successful as a club and we had unity and we had togetherness and we had a collective aim and a collective spirit. And all three of those managers, Martin Ling, Russell Slade and Justin Edinburgh, all three of those managers added up the sum of all their parts and managed to get to more than 100%. And that is so important. You can't underestimate that. I would take that over talent any day of the week, you know, because what we've seen at our level as a football club like us, embedded in a community in East London and you know, West Essex to some extent as well, you know, we are a vital part of a lot of people's lives, and we've got to reward them for that loyalty. So we can do that by working hard and by being honest and being together. And those three seasons in particular, we did that. And it's because of that that we had success on the pitch, not because we had success on the pitch that the other stuff came about. We did things right as a club, and they were the right people in charge, and they were the people who could mastermind that success by getting that extra 10% out when everybody else could only get to 100%. They could get to 110%. So they're my highlights that, you know, away from, you know, there might be a few other little bits and pieces away from, you know, most people's awareness, but they're more personal. You know, if I look at what's benefited the club as a whole over the last 20 years or so, I would say those, you know, those three things more so than anything else. And then what do I hope for the future? Well, I think, you know, we are a top half League One team. Are we a Championship team? Not really, but can we have the odd go at getting into the Championship? Yes, we can. So let's get back into League One. We probably, you know, we gave ourselves 6 years when we took the club back over, and, you know, assuming that this season is going to finish in some way, shape or form as year three, we think we're on track for that. We call on the fans to keep their support, keep their patience, keep their understanding, keep realistic. You know, we're never going to be a big spender. We're never going to be able to hold on to every young player, because we actually want them to go on to bigger and better things, because that's what they deserve and it does our reputation good. And as long as we get rewarded for it properly, then it's the right thing to happen. So, you know, we want to keep as a strong part of the East London community and keep rewarding people for putting their faith in us. And especially at this time now, when the club's on the pause button, really, it's about keeping the faith and keeping memories of the good times alive to incentivise us to want to get back into Brisbane Road and see the boys play again.
Absolutely, Matt. And, you know, during this pause period, as you put it, you know, the club has been so proactive in its work, not least with the FIFA tournaments and such.
Yeah.
You were talking about sort of hard work and yourself, Matt. I don't know of anybody over the years that have worked as hard as you have for Leighton Orient. Your guidance and your courage and your determination, I think, where we see Leighton Orient now, and it's so easy to take it for granted, but we mentioned Bromley, losing 6-1 away at Bromley to being in such a healthy position now, and realistically looking forward to the possibility of pushing to get back into League One. You have played such a major role in that achievement, Matt, and all I can do is say thank you. What you've achieved at Leighton Orient is quite remarkable, Matt.
Well, it's very kind of you to say so. Lucky this is an audio call, not a video call, or you'd see me blushing. But look, Dave, there's probably 5,000 other Orient fans out there who would have, you know, who would have done the same as me. I was fortunate in that I got given those opportunities, and, you know, through a combination of hard work and a bit of luck, and, you know, maybe I knew what I was doing on a couple of bits here and there every now and again, we managed to get some things over the line. We didn't get everything right, and we won't do going forward, but as I've always said to anybody who's asked me, if we're honest and we can look you in the eye when we're giving you the answer, then that's, you know, that's as much as we can do. So, you know, we'll keep doing that. And if I can play any sort of role in that going forward, it's great for me to have a little bit of a back seat now and watch Danny and Nigel and Kent and everybody at the club, Martin, Lindsay, everybody, you know, doing what they're doing to keep moving us forward. You know, I'm enjoying it. I love taking Henry down there, my 3-year-old. You know, I won't force him to support Orient, but if he chooses to, then he can have a lifetime of ups and downs like I've had and we've all had.
Absolutely. Matt, again, thank you so much for taking the time, and we wish you all the best for you and your family to stay well. And I look forward to seeing you back at the Bray Group Stadium very soon, shortly.
Yeah, very much so, Dave. Hope everybody stays safe, stays well, stays positive, and, you know, we look forward to meeting again in happier times.